Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 13, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special author's edition of the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the new book, Bad History, Worse Policy, with author Peter Wallison. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from Mr. Wallison of about 25 minutes when he'll be outlining the thesis of his book, and then we'll take your audience questions. Peter J. Wallison is the Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. There, he is also a co-director of AEI's Program on Financial Policy Studies. He researches banking, insurance, and securities regulation. And as always, with these calls, his bio has been provided to you in the notice you got for this call and is available on our website. Additionally, he has generously agreed to make his book available to our audience today for the discounted price of $30. I'd note that the retail price is $90. The Amazon Prime member web price is $66. So he'd like to make this book as widely available as possible. If you can send a check to $30 here to the Federal Society to my attention, made out to AEI, I will pass those orders along to AEI. And he also wanted to let you know that he's happy to sign those books. So if you have an inscription request, include that in the mailing. But with that, Mr. Wallison, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thanks very much, Dean. And good to talk to all of you. Bad History, Worse Policy is the name of the book. It has a subtitle, which kind of gives a better flavor of what it's about. The subtitle is How a False Narrative About the Financial Crisis Led to the Dodd-Frank Act. Now, Bad History, Worse Policy makes the simple point that every major public policy is based on a narrative of some kind, a description of how a problem came about, and hence what changes are necessary to resolve it or prevent a recurrence. And that narrative, and the narrative about the financial crisis, the one that is conventional and understood and read in the newspapers every day, is false. And what's more, it was never even debated. And that's an important point. In cases involving major national issues, there is almost always a debate about the substance of the narrative on which the differing views are eventually heard and evaluated. An example of this process is the current debate about whether human activity is causing climate change. There is an ongoing controversy about the facts, of course, in which each side understands but disputes the arguments of the other. Eventually, a decision is made. Not everyone is or will be reconciled, but everyone had a chance to participate at some level. Other examples that are in a similar process of resolution are the immigration issue, gun control, entitlement spending. In these cases, the issues have been joined, and the debate will eventually produce an outcome. The continuing abortion controversy, however, is an example of what happens when this process does not occur. There, the matter was decided by the Supreme Court before any kind of public debate had occurred. The result has been a continuing turmoil and even violence. In the book, I argue that there was never any significant debate about the causes of the 2008 financial crisis. Although there were two narratives about why it happened, only one of them was accepted and propagated by the media. In effect, the necessary competition in ideas never occurred. As a result, the policy that was adopted, that is the Dodd-Frank Act, is not soundly based in any kind of political consensus, and I believe that leaves the legitimacy of the act in question for the foreseeable future. The Dodd-Frank Act is based on a narrative developed entirely by the left. It places responsibility for the financial crisis wholly on the private sector, and particularly on the large Wall Street commercial and investment banks. In this narrative, to the extent that government had any role at all, it was in failing to regulate adequately either these institutions on Wall Street or the mortgage originators who profited by selling people mortgages they couldn't afford. The book traces the influence of this narrative into the specific provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act. So the provisions, as the book describes them, are related directly to elements in the narrative. I contend in the book that this narrative is false, as I indicated before. It's bad history and produced worse policy. It is certainly true that the private sector had some role in the financial crisis, but it was relatively minor when compared to the government's effort through both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations to degrade mortgage underwriting standards in order to increase home ownership. This contrary view was never put before the American people in time to have its implications considered in the debate over Dodd-Frank. If that debate had occurred, it is unlikely that the Dodd-Frank Act would have been enacted in anything like its current form. Why this did not occur, why there was no competition in ideas on the causes of the financial crisis, is largely what my book summary today will be about. For those not familiar with the argument that the financial crisis was caused by government policy, let me state it as succinctly as I can. Before 1992, the vast majority of mortgages in the United States were prime mortgages with down payments of from 10 to 20% and made to people with good credit records. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were the principal enforcers of these rules. Delinquencies and defaults were few. In 1992, however, Congress enacted legislation that required Fannie and Freddie to meet what were called affordable housing goals. The legislation initially required that at least 30% of the mortgages Fannie and Freddie acquired have been made to borrowers at or below the median income in their communities. HUD was given authority to increase that quota, and it did so, raising the quota to 50% by the end of the Clinton administration and to 55% in the Bush administration. It's important to note that this is not a partisan argument. Both the Clinton and Bush administrations, both Republicans and Democrats, were involved in this process and pursued it with vigor. Statements by HUD throughout this period, that is from the beginning in 1992 through 2007, when things kind of came apart, made clear that the agency's intention was to reduce underwriting standards in order to make mortgage credit available to a larger number of borrowers, at least in part, to increase home ownership. Now, there is no ambiguity about that. Those statements are very clear in the record, although HUD now hides its position behind blaming Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It was difficult for Fannie and Freddie to find prime quality mortgages among borrowers who were at or below the median income, especially when the quota had reached 50% by the year 2000. So in the mid-1990s, they began to reduce their underwriting standards, accepting 3% down payments by 1995 and 0% down payments by the year 2000. Acceptable borrower FICO scores, and FICO is a credit scoring system that is used very widely in the financial business. These acceptable FICO scores were also reduced by Fannie and Freddie in their effort to find mortgages that would meet the affordable housing requirements. Because Fannie and Freddie were the dominant players in and largely set the standards for the housing market, these lower underwriting requirements spread throughout the market, not just to those mortgages that qualified for the affordable housing goals. Now, this was a natural result of competition. If Fannie and Freddie were accepting subprime mortgages for low-income borrowers, they could hardly refuse to accept the same kinds of mortgages for borrowers with the ability to make a substantial down payment or with good FICO scores. The availability of government support for low-quality mortgages and the easy availability of mortgage credit substantially increased demand for housing and built an enormous housing bubble, 9 times larger than any previous bubble, between 1997 and 2007. By 2008, half of all mortgages in this bubble, and that would be about 28 million loans, were subprime or otherwise low quality. Of these, 3/4 were on the books of government agencies, such as FHA, or other entities controlled by the government, such as Fannie and Freddie. And this shows, the fact that these mortgages were on the books of these government agencies shows incontrovertibly, it seems to me, where the demand for these loans actually came from and why these mortgages proliferated. When the bubble finally deflated in 2007 and 8, these loans defaulted in unprecedented numbers, driving down housing values and weakening financial institutions in the United States and around the world. When Lehman Brothers collapsed, a financial panic ensued, with banks and other financial institutions hoarding cash and refusing to lend to one another. And that, in fact, was the 2008 financial crisis. It's not as though these facts were unknown or unknowable. Fannie and Freddie, two of the largest financial firms in the world, were taken over by the government before Lehman failed because they were insolvent. And you don't become insolvent by acquiring and guaranteeing prime mortgages. Including in the book is an essay that Charlie Calamiris, who you may have heard of, he's a professor at Columbia Business School, an article we wrote together in September 2008, the same month that Lehman failed, outlining Fannie and Freddie's role in the crisis. Republican members of Congress and conservatives inherently skeptical of what they are told by the news media were eventually able to put the facts together. So it is now widely believed by policy-conscious Republicans and conservatives that the financial crisis was caused by the government's housing policies. Every major Republican candidate for president in 2012 said this during the primary debates, and Marco Rubio repeated it in his response to the president's State of the Union message. Even George W. Bush, in his memoirs, admitted that he'd made a mistake in giving excessive support to efforts to increase home ownership. The left seems desperately afraid that this idea will gain wide currency. Although there was only one sentence on the subject in Senator Rubio's response to the State of the Union message, the left's blogosphere, from Paul Krugman on down, exploded with rage. Idiotic, they called it. Thoroughly refuted, they argued. And they used the perennial favorite on the left, it's a lie. This is the way Rubio's comment, single sentence, was characterized. My AEI colleague, Ed Pinto, and I were once accused by Joe Nocera, he's the New York Times columnist, of using the big lie technique for suggesting that the government had a major role in the financial crisis. It doesn't get much worse, I think, than being compared to Joseph Goebbels. Most Americans have no idea that there is an alternative view of what caused the financial crisis. The result is an odd gap in public discourse on this issue. As an illustration, when I am interviewed about the financial crisis, I am often asked why no bankers have been sued personally or tried criminally for causing the crisis. And I usually respond by saying I don't think that the bankers caused the crisis. This appears to leave interviewers completely dumbfounded. They seem to have no frame of reference with which to interpret this response. I then have to explain my views about what were the actual causes of the crisis, and those who hear it have to take in a rather complicated description of events that in many cases is entirely new to them. This would not happen, for example, in an interview about climate change. If I were asked whether the U.S. should reduce its reliance on fossil fuels in order to prevent climate change, listeners would understand that there are two views of the subject, those who believe that human activity caused climate change and those who are skeptical about it. If I respond that I think we need more study of this issue before we take steps that seriously hinder economic growth, most listeners will understand the views underlying my remarks, even if they disagree. They have heard the narrative that if we reduce the use of fossil fuels, we will suppress economic growth. However, because most Americans have not heard anything about an alternative explanation of the financial crisis, they have no frame of reference for it other than as a disaster caused by the Wall Street banks. Why do we have this unusual gap in public knowledge about one of the most significant economic events of the last 100 years? Obviously, there was a major flaw in media coverage, and the reasons for that are not hard to discern. It is no secret that the media is dominated by the left, and the left has always had suspicions about capitalism as an economic system. Not only is capitalism regarded as Darwinian, as an enemy of equality, but it is also seen as inherently unstable and prone to crashes. That's why immediately after the Lehman default and the resulting chaos, the media were full of commentary that this was the end of capitalism. It had finally revealed itself as too dangerous to be allowed to function without government controls. The fact that Lehman's default and the ensuing chaos occurred so completely, agreed so completely with the left's view of the U.S. economic system, allowed many on the left and in the media to view it as confirmation of something they'd always believed and not a debatable issue. In this sense, to this group, other explanations were dilatory and a waste of time. This was also fine with those in government at the time, at Treasury and Fed, in the Congress and at HUD. These are officials who did not want attention drawn to their role in the calamity. Spokesmen at these institutions, no doubt on background, fed the left's and the media's narrative with scare stories about the dangers of credit default swaps and the irresponsibility of unregulated mortgage originators. The crisis also served the interests of another group with a loud voice in the subject, and that is financial regulators. We're all familiar with the remarkable fact that regulators get more power when they fail. Witness Sarbanes-Oxley, FIREA, and FIDISHA. I will not go through the details of each of these laws, but each was contained a new set of powers for regulators who had recently failed. In the case of the financial crisis, financial regulators were quick on the draw with new regulations that would impose more controls on the financial industry. The Fed, which arguably was the most at fault for failing to see this crisis coming, got the most new powers, becoming in effect the Uber regulator of the financial system, with the potential eventually to regulate all large insurance companies, finance companies, hedge funds, money market mutual funds, as well as banks and bank holding companies. This is truly a case of not letting a good crisis go to waste. Nor has the steam gone out of the regulatory engine yet. If you read the speeches of Fed officials and other bank regulators from around the world, you'll find that they are eager to somehow get control of the securities market. The code words here, and I'm sure many of you have heard them, are shadow banking, a clever suggestion that the securities industry is engaged in banking on the sly without the necessary regulation. The reality is that the securities industry is a more efficient supplier of funds to the real economy than banks. It is simply less costly to sell bonds, notes, and commercial paper to investors than for it is to companies to borrow from a bank. Since the mid-1980s, by intermediating these transactions, the securities industry has supplied 15 times more financing to the real economy than the banks have, and it is done largely without government prudential regulation. When the financial crisis came, lightly regulated investment banks like Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch did no worse than heavily regulated FDIC-insured commercial banks like Wachovia, Washington Mutual, and IndyMac. So it's hard to see that more and tighter regulation is really the answer. What we are watching, I think, in the name of prudential regulation, is the government gradually squeezing the life out of the banking industry, the way the Interstate Commerce Commission gradually squeezed the life out of the railroads. If we let government insure and provide prudential regulation to the securities business, as some regulators have now proposed, we'll pay a heavy price in lost economic growth. Finally, when natural supporters of free markets and members of the financial industry were made aware of what had happened, they were shaken by the crisis and were slow to resist the tide of adverse commentary in the media. Without an alternative explanation of what occurred, officials of banks and other financial institutions had to admit that they did many of the things that were now cited in the media as causes of the crisis. These uncoerced confessions came because these people had no idea that while they had bought, held, and securitized subprime mortgages, the government had done the same with three times as many. That was not reported in the media, and without this information, it was plausible that their own actions could have been responsible for the financial crisis that they saw around them. A good example of this phenomenon is Michael Symbolist, who is the chief investment officer at J.P. Morgan Chase. Symbolist circulates a newsletter to friends and clients, and in 2009, he used it to blame banks like his own for making the irresponsible and risky mortgage underwriting decisions that brought on the financial crisis. This was to be expected. The only information he had was that he is what he had read in the newspapers or saw on television. He knew what Chase had done, but did not know what the government's role had been. Then one day he ran across my dissent from the majority report of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I had been a member of that commission and dissented from their majority report, which was just issued in January of 2011. I argued that it was government housing policy, and particularly the affordable housing requirements that were imposed on Fannie and Freddie, just what I talked about with you before, that drove down underwriting standards, built an enormous housing price bubble, and caused the financial crisis. He then looked further at the data assembled by Ed Pinto and concluded that he had been wrong. It's not that Ed Pinto, incidentally, is a colleague of mine at AEI. I think you probably have heard of his work. It's not that J.P. Morgan Chase had not done the things that Symbolist had initially cited. It was just that the contributions of the banks and the private sector were only a small part of a much larger picture. Once he was aware of the larger picture, he used his newsletter to issue a retraction of his earlier judgment. With the left, two administrations, the media, and the regulatory apparatus all singing from the same hymnal, and the private sector unaware of what really happened, very few people were willing to question the claim that the financial crisis was the fault of the private sector. Even if there were voices in defense of capitalism, their views were seldom given attention in the media. I had a particularly remarkable experience with this problem while a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. The commission scheduled several public hearings, which were televised on C-SPAN. The media were almost always present as observers in the room or were watching the proceedings on television. In several of the hearings, I asked witnesses whether they were aware that there were 25 million subprime and other low-quality mortgages in the financial system in 2008, before the financial crisis. That was the number I had at the time. Since then, Ed Pinto's work has shown that there were, in fact, 28 million subprime and other low-quality mortgages. That's the number I mentioned earlier. In 2008, 28 million, but I knew at the time there were only 25 million, which was still half of all mortgages. And all the of all the witnesses I asked, and in all cases they were people who should have known, they all said they had never heard such a thing. They'd never heard of so many subprime mortgages. The fact that 25 million subprime or other non-prime mortgages were in the financial system in 2008, again almost half of all mortgages, was undoubtedly news. It had never been reported before, as I said it, and it was a shocking number. Yet I have never found a single reference to it in any major media report on the FCI's hearings where I made the statement. And I never received a call from a reporter asking where I'd come up with that number. Publication of the 25 million number would have led immediately to questions about how so many of these weak mortgages got into the financial system and where they were located. I would have been able to show that only a minority of these non-prime mortgages were on the books of banks or other private financial institutions, and that most of them were on the books of government agencies. Yet my statement never evoked the slightest media interest and, of course, was never covered in the FCIC's report. In addition, at the time the FCIC's report was published, I issued a 43,000-word dissent with a great deal of data showing that the housing policies of the government and not the private sector, not its greed, its irresponsibility, or its predatory lending, had caused the crisis. The substance of the dissent got no more than a sentence in any major newspaper and was not covered at all in any of the major broadcast or cable media. In the months that followed, only Fox News interviewed me about my view of the financial crisis, and that was part of a program that, to Fox's credit, included a lot of material that also pointed to private sector responsibility. But I was never interviewed at all about my dissent on ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, of course, or the PBS NewsHour, despite the fact that the same data I had included in the dissent had persuaded Republican senators and members of Congress to vote virtually unanimously against the Dodd-Frank Act. It's no wonder, then, that the American people still believe that the banks and other financial institutions were the sole cause of the financial crisis. There still has been no competition in ideas. If it does nothing else, through its collected essays, and I should have mentioned at the beginning that the book is a collection of essays I'd written between 2004 and 2012 on the subjects of the GSEs, the financial crisis, and then the Dodd-Frank Act. The book should show that from the beginning there was a competitive narrative, but before the opening bell had been sounded in this fight, the referee had declared a winner. That's all I'll say right now, but I'd be happy to talk about, to answer any questions. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. We're listening to Peter Wallison, and let me start, this is Dean Reuter, by reiterating his kind offer for discounted copies of his book. Its retail price is $90. Its Amazon.com price is $66. But he'd like to have this in circulation as widely as possible. If you make a check for $30 out to AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, send it here to my attention at the Federalist Society. I will forward those along. He'd also be happy to sign those books for you if you want to include information on an inscription. Let's see what's on the mind of the audience right now. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, if you have a question for Peter Wallison, push the star button and then the pound button. While we're waiting to see if any of the audience members have a question, our lines are open, push star and then pound. Let me make a somewhat long-winded programming announcement. We've got one more Teleforum conference call on the schedule for this week. On Friday at 2 p.m., we'll be looking at matters concerning the EPA and some anticipated regulation they have on fixed sources and greenhouse gases. Next week, we're planning calls on the Arizona versus Intertribal Council U.S. Supreme Court case. That case is going to be argued on Monday. Our expert, Eric Jaffe, is going to attend the argument and participate in a Teleforum conference call at 2 p.m. on Monday. at the same number. That case, by the way, concerns the interaction of federal and state voter laws, voter ID laws in particular. That is next Monday at 2 p.m. Then next Wednesday at 2 p.m., our call is going to feature a recap of a recently decided and very important Seventh Circuit Second Amendment case in which an opinion by Judge Richard Posner struck down an Illinois statewide ban on carry permits. That's next Wednesday at 2. And then next Thursday, also at 2 o'clock, we're going to continue our NLRB series of teleform conference calls with a call looking at the NLRB's posting regulations. So that's Thursday at 2. Mr. Wallison, you've provoked a few people here. We've got no fewer than 5 questions to start us off. So let's go to our first caller.
Mr. Wallison, this is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. Thank you for an excellent presentation. Dodd-Frank is one of those bills that has so many things in it, and who knows how many people in Congress read it before they voted on it. And there's so many pages in it, a couple thousand pages, as I understand, and there's going to be hundreds of thousands and millions of pages of regulations that have yet been written. Is there anything in there that's worth saving that has some beneficial impact on the financial markets and industry?
You know, I've looked through the act. I can't say that I have read every word. Some people claim to have done that. It is a massive thing, and hard to read, of course, in the statutory form. I really can't think of anything in the act that I would think would really improve conditions in the financial markets if left in place. It is the kind of thing that controls what financial institutions do. In fact, in some of the essays that are in this book, I refer to the Dodd-Frank Act as Obamacare for the financial system, because it has very many of the features of Obamacare. In particular, Obamacare, as you probably know, it leaves the health insurance industry largely in the hands of private investors, private shareholders. But it takes such control of how they do business that the shareholders and the managements are not really in control of the thing they own. And that's just about true with Dodd-Frank and financial institutions. The controls that the statute provides for the government to take over the financial institutions, especially the very largest ones, are massive and do, in fact, make them wards of the government in many, many important ways. So it's very hard for me to find in that mass of regulatory and statutory material anything that I would want to save. It seems to me it could all be repealed with no bad effect on the economy.
We've got, it looks like, 2, 4, 5 questions pending at this point. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps we can explore what the most important problems are in the private financial sector and how, as a matter of public policy, we might more accurately and appropriately address them. There does indeed seem to be a problem of excessive speculation and a debt bubble, which is related to mortgages in part, but also extends to fiat currencies, to commercial debt, to consumer debt, sovereign debt. And if allowed to proceed, it's likely to be catastrophic. So what, if anything, can we do about that?
I have a reaction against the idea that there is anything called excessive speculation. I don't see that speculation in itself is wrong in any degree. It is a very important way that prices and other ways of allocating assets are kept under control, because we always have people betting against or betting for. Speculation can be troublesome where the government has encouraged it in some way. And so I think my answer to your question about how we deal with excessive speculation is to keep the government out of the business of trying to move the market in one direction or another. That is one of the things that adds the least informed speculation to the markets, because people begin to bet on whether the government is going to take this action or that action, and those things turn out to be not based on judgments that people can actually make about the direction of markets or the availability of commodities or things of the kind that are the subject of a lot of speculation, but rather bets on what government decisions are going to be made for political reasons, and that's very, very arbitrary. So I can't really say that we need any controls over speculation if that speculation is based on the usual economic and financial issues that it covers.
So you were saying quantitative easing is a bad idea?
Yeah, I don't think quantitative easing is a good idea.
All right, but now we've been doing it now for several years. Where do we go from here?
Well, if I could answer that question, I would be a candidate for being chairman of the Federal Reserve. I'm not sure that the Fed knows what to do about the results of their quantitative easing. Once they started on it with QE1, I think they expected that it would have more of an effect on the housing, on the job market, than it actually has had. So then they went to QE2, and that hasn't had any effect. And now they're in QE3 and are having to make statements such as, "We will continue to keep interest rates at their near zero level until unemployment comes down to 6.5%. The trouble with all of this is that they've waded in very far. They've committed the Fed to huge amounts of assets, which the Fed is now holding. And if the economy does decide, does for some reason start to improve, if unemployment does in fact improve and the economy begins to grow, the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates. And if they do that, they will lose enormous amounts of money on the assets that they are holding, because the assets are paying very little. The Fed is paying interest rates that are close to zero. The Fed is receiving interest rates on those assets that is pretty close to zero. And yet, when interest rates start to go up, that will mean that all of those assets will lose value, tremendous losses in value for the Fed. So I don't know how they're going to get out of this situation, but I think it was a mistake to get into it in the first place. And you can see that in hindsight, because all of this very odd speculative activity has not benefited our economy in any way. It has left things much as they were when the process began. And I ought to mention one other thing, and I think that one of the reasons that our economy is in such poor condition right now is the result, I think, of Dodd-Frank. Now, not many people, are thinking this, and the reason for that is that it is very hard to measure what regulation does in affecting the economy's growth. It's much easier to measure, at least, what QE1, QE2, QE3 are doing than it is to figure how regulation affects businesses. But the recession that we had after the financial crisis ended in June of 2009. up to that point, the economy had actually started to recover. It was growing at about to an average of 2.5% before, in the period after 2009 and up until July of 2010, when the Dodd-Frank Act was adopted. So in that year, we had begun to see some real growth developing. Right after the Dodd-Frank Act was enacted, growth fell. And since then, and it has fallen in each year more than the year after, than the year before, all the way up until the end of 2012. And so the average since Dodd-Frank has been a growth rate of about 2%. I think that Dodd-Frank is the cause of the problem and would not have been affected in any way by QE1, 2, or QE3. The way to restore growth is to restore more private judgments to the financial industry and get the government out of its strict controls in that area. It's the uncertainties created by Dodd-Frank, the controls placed on the financial institutions, either now or to be placed on them in the future when these regulations are done, which are really the cause of the failure of our economy to grow and the failure to employ more people.
If you'd like to join the conversation, we're speaking with Peter Wallison, author of Bad History, Worse Policy. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. You can join the queue. Let's go to our next caller.
Mr. Wallison, this is Tom Kelly from Minneapolis. Question for you. On the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, there were two dissents. One was your dissent, which we'll say was a very strong dissent, and the other was a milder dissent by the other Republican members of the commission. Why were you not able to bring more of the Republican members of the commission over to your view as to what caused the crisis?
That's a question I have been wrestling with for a long time. And I'm very hesitant to answer it because I don't want to impugn anyone's motives. Some things, though, are fairly obvious, and I hadn't really thought of them before and probably should have. And that is that at least one member of that other Republican group had been in the Bush administration. He was a high official in the White House, and to join my dissent would have meant that he was criticizing his own administration. So that's something that I think it would be difficult for anyone to do. And so why the others did that, I don't know. But I would say that in some of my criticism in the dissent, I criticized some of the really important sacred cows of the left, like the Community Reinvestment Act. And if you criticize the Community Reinvestment Act, your chances of being appointed to any position in any government, in any Republican government, would be substantially diminished because the Democrats in the Senate would probably filibuster your nomination. So I can't tell really why people might have done it, but these kinds of factors could have played into their thinking.
Thank you.
We've got two more callers lined up with questions. If you want to join the line, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, Mr. Wallison, thank you for your presentation. This is David Emerson in Berkeley, California. A couple of brief questions. I'm hoping you could take one perhaps as an opportunity to get up on a bit of a soapbox as well. The first one has to do with more the kinds of factors which bring poor government policy under control and the role of the financial market in doing that. it seems to me, at least, that the implied government guarantee of Fannie and Freddie was a factor in allowing the situation to get as bad as it was. And in the absence of such a guarantee, the financial markets perhaps would have stepped in much sooner and exerted influence on the government policy indirectly. I'd like to get your comments on that, both as sort of this too big to fail factor. And then the other comment I have, and this is where you have an opportunity for a soapbox, is there also seems to be a rather massive failure of the Fourth Estate, the press, the media, in performing its customary role in scrutiny of the government. I'd like to get your thoughts on what might be a potential remedy for that.
Okay, well, those are really good questions, David. Thank you. On the first, this question of the implied guarantee is really extremely important. The reason that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac came to dominate the financial housing finance system was because of the implied guarantee of the government. Even though their debt was explicitly not backed by the government in the legislation that chartered them, nevertheless, the market always believed that Fannie and Freddie would be protected if they ever failed. And that was even before the true concept of too big to fail occurred. Even in the 1980s, in the late 1970s, there was still a sense that Fannie and Freddie were carrying out a government mission and therefore would never be allowed to fail, even though the government did not explicitly stand behind their debt. And that is what enabled them to gobble up the market, to control the market. They were by far the largest players in the market and set the standards for the market. And as I indicated in my initial discussion, those standards were actually pretty good in terms of the mortgage quality that they were insisting upon. In fact, those standards were so good that activists on the left were trying for years until they finally succeeded in 1992 to somehow get Fannie and Freddie to stop insisting on good quality mortgages. That's what the affordable housing goals were all about when they were adopted in 1992. It was to force Fannie and Freddie to start making credit available to people who they would not otherwise receive credit because their standards were too high. So the fact that Fannie and Freddie had the government backing really enabled them to control the market, and that's why the market deteriorated so much after the affordable housing requirements were adopted. Now, as to the massive failure of the media here, and that is something I talked about in my earlier discussion, that is an odd phenomenon from my point of view. I mean, this should have been something the media would have dug into. But the fact is that first of all, I guess there are two things. One is the complexity of the issue. We had this enormous financial crisis, something no one had ever seen before. All of the great financial gurus, people who had been in the Fed and people who academics of note had never seen anything like this before, and so it was not something people were prepared to talk about, and this is very important, Fannie and Freddie had failed to disclose, had refused to disclose the quality of the mortgages that they were buying. And so at the time that the financial crisis occurred, no one understood that Fannie and Freddie had created as many of these subprime and other low-quality mortgages as they had. People tended to think that the subprime mortgage problem was very small. All they knew about was what the private sector had done, which, as I indicated, was about one quarter of all the low-quality mortgages were the responsibility of the private sector, people thought that was all of the low-quality mortgages that were in the financial system. None were created by or held by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, was the view. In fact, for years, people thought the very definition of a subprime mortgage was one that Fannie and Freddie would not buy. So when it turned out that Fannie and Freddie had bought so many of these mortgages and were holding so many, and that the government itself, Fannie and Freddie being the major factors here, that government agencies themselves held about three-quarters of all the subprime mortgages, that didn't come out until well after the blame had started to shift, or really was directed from the beginning toward the private sector. The media not being very sophisticated about these matters, not being able to go to people who had the facts about what actually happened, adopted that idea. And as I said in my initial discussion, that was very much in accord with their predilections and their ideology. The media is, of course, dominated by the left, and the idea that the government might have caused this terrible calamity was not something they were willing easily to accept. And it made much more sense to them in terms of their world outlook that it was the private sector that did it. And if the government kept feeding them information that fostered that idea, and so it became the dominant and finally the only idea that the media accepted. And so now one sees in the newspapers or hears on television the statement, straight out, the banks that caused the financial crisis did this or that, or it has been discovered that the banks that caused the financial crisis actually failed to do the following, when it's very much in doubt that the banks caused the financial crisis. But that's not something anyone in the media, or at least any significant number of people in the media, are willing to admit.
We have one more caller with a question at this point. I think we have time for an additional question after that. If you want to ask the final question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, Peter. Ben Carl calling from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for your presentation. I have a couple questions for you. The first has to do just with the future of mortgage-backed securities in the secondary market. At this point, as you've been sort of casting the finger at the government and its actions, and rightfully so to a certain extent, the government is now running Fannie and Freddie through the FHFA, and the FHFA, hence, is now in control of at least 80%, if not more, of the secondary market for mortgage-backed securities. So how do we change that? Like at this point in history, what is the way out? I mean, I know the FHFA has indicated that they, that they've come up with 5-year plans, and they talk about transitioning out of this sort of top-heavy market. But really, what incentive does the FHFA have in not playing such a heavy role, given the nature of the thinking in that agency? So, if you could sort of give us sort of a roadmap for the opening up the private sector again for mortgage-backed securities, given the history, that would be helpful. And I guess the second part of my question, or second question, is really related to the first, and that has to do with an entity called MERS, which was created by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and is to this day owned 50% by Fannie and Freddie, and has been the subject of recent banking regulation and a lot of state by state fights over how it affects the local state recording jurisdictions. I think from a financial perspective, the largest issue is just the delays that are caused in foreclosure actions and in put-back litigation regarding just fighting over MERS. And it will probably continue to be a target for years to come. Well, how does the Fannie and Freddie's relationship with MERS impact the future of the recovery? If you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah,
Peter, this is Dean Reuter breaking in here. Just before you get to those questions, I want to let you know we did have a final caller with a question, so we've got one more pending, and we've got about 5 minutes, but go right ahead.
Okay, thanks. All right, let me just cover then just your first question, and that is what do we do about Fannie and Freddie now? How do we withdraw them from the market? We have a remarkable public servant as the director of the FHFA, the Federal Housing Financial Agency, and that's Ed DeMarco. Ed is one of those very rare people who is much more interested in accomplishing something during his tenure than simply holding office and carrying things through without making too many changes. Ed is trying very hard to make some very useful changes. The most important of those is to raise the what are called the guarantee fees of Fannie and Freddie. One of the reasons they dominated the market was because, as we now know, the taxpayers were taking the risk of owning and guaranteeing mortgages, and as a result, Fannie and Freddie were able to charge much less for guaranteeing a mortgage than any private sector organization would, and also they were able to pay much more for the mortgages that they wanted than private sector organizations were, because Fannie and Freddie could borrow at a rate that was only slightly more than what the Treasury was paying. So they dominated the market because of their government backing. What DeMarco is trying to do now is to equalize the costs of Fannie and Freddie and the private sector. If he can raise the guarantee fees of Fannie and Freddie high enough, and he's promised that he will do it, that will make it possible for the private sector to come in and start securitizing again. And to the extent that they can do that, they will begin to return to their position, not dominant, but at least strong in terms of financing houses in this country. And commensurately, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will decline. So I think it is possible for FHA to do something very significant here, and Ed DeMarco has been doing it. I'm sure that the Obama administration would like to get rid of Ed DeMarco, but they can't do it because the Senate is refusing to confirm a full-time director for the office, and Ed continues there as the acting director. But as long as that's true, we will begin to see some really important changes in the way Fannie and Freddie operate so that the private sector can come back.
All right, let's take our final question.
Hi, this is Tom Kelly again. First, I just want to say, as somebody who was in the mortgage industry during the bubble years and saw this whole thing unravel up close and personal, I appreciate what you're saying. It's something that's needed to be said and that not enough people have said. Secondly, I have a question that goes to your statement that Fannie and Freddie, or the government agencies collectively, had 3/4 of the subprime market. Are you including in that their purchases of private label MBS, or is that in addition to their very significant role in enabling the private sector to securitize subprime loans?
That includes their purchase of private label MBS. They were the major purchasers of private label MBS, and in material that they have that has since become public, that is data, messages inside Fannie and Freddie and statements that they were making to one another during the time this was going on, suggest that, in fact, show that they bought these private label mortgage-backed securities in order to meet the affordable housing requirements. These MBS based on subprime loans were very rich in affordable housing goals eligible loans, and that was the reason that they sought these mortgage-backed securities, and that's one of the reasons they and the other government agencies had 74% of all of the outstanding subprime and other weak mortgages.
Very good. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Mr. Peter Wallison for joining us today. To our audience, I want a reminder about Mr. Wallison's offer for the reduced price copies of his book. Send your check here to my attention, but made out to AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, in the amount of $30. I also invite our audience to join us for our teleform conference call Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing the EPA. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.